Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Well, hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm your host, Eric Peabody, and tonight's episode features two frightening tales. To open, we'll be reading Quiet Desperation by Clarence Carter. In this story, our protagonist, Hank, is in a tough spot. Being a single parent raising a teenage child would be hard enough, but Hank's business has also just gone under, and the loan sharks are closing in. What's a desperate man to do? Well, one potential option, and the one that Hank has settled on, is robbing graves. Even though he's avoided arrest, committing such a nefarious act tends to open one up to all sorts of repercussions. After that, we'll round out the evening with Wearisome Necessary Things by J.R. Hamantaschen. This story focuses on Jeff Damrick, a new father with a freshly minted infant. For his whole life, Jeff's sort of felt like a failure, and he's having trouble incorporating his new paternal role into his self-image. On top of that, he starts having bizarre interactions with strangers that seem to know more about him than they should. As with J.R. Hamantaschen's other stories that we've featured on this show, this one walks the line between the real and the dreamlike to great effect. And now, from author Clarence Carter, I give you Quiet Desperation. In a group full of mourners, one man's eyes were dry. He stood amongst them, black suit, head bowed. Inches from the grave sat a table bearing pictures of the deceased. If anyone asked, he'd say he was a family friend. Hank knew very little of Lizzie McLaughlin besides what he'd read in the paper. A woman in a black veil sat beside him with a tissue in her hand. She cried in low, garbled noises. Her eyes were bloodshot. Hank turned away, evading her gaze. Rows of headstones covered the rolling greens of the cemetery. Freshly cut grass lingered on the breeze. A canopy on wheels shadowed the grave, suppressing only some heat. The preacher stood at the front, holding the podium. He spoke in a slow, dedicated cadence, perfected by those versed in public speaking. As the grieving comforted each other, Hank observed the minor details. He noted the cars they drove and the clothing they wore, all of which were signs of wealth. These people weren't Walmart shoppers. Hank approached the casket to say his goodbyes, which consisted of scouting. He'd attended 7 funerals in the past month and dug 1 grave. Or undug, really. With hands clasped in prayer, he surveyed. Through the tufts of gray hair, he saw diamond earrings. A gold necklace hung, barely visible from her collared shirt. The shimmering silver bracelet and the diamond ring caught his attention, too. Part of that Henry David Thoreau quote rolled through his mind. The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. He'd never known desperation like this before. The woman had enough loot in her coffin to buy him more time before they closed his. A young man of about 20 made eye contact. Hank couldn't abandon the ship. It was too obvious. His heart thundered in his chest as he approached. When the man stood before him, he realized he'd been holding his breath. "Thanks for coming," he said. Hank nodded a sympathetic nod. When the man passed, he sighed a breath of relief. As the crowd dispersed, he crossed the cemetery to his truck. Stepping over every headstone, Hank apologized in his head. Intentionally, he'd parked the truck far away from the family in an effort not to be remembered. The blazer landed on the back seat. For the millionth time, the stack of bills crossed his mind. They were suffocating. If he couldn't provide for his daughter, his ex-wife would take her away. He couldn't live with himself if that happened. The truck rumbled to life, and he beat the other cars out of the cemetery. He checked over his shoulder several times to ensure he had yet to be followed. The brakes screeched outside the bakery he'd frequented for years. He stepped out, looking up and down the main drag for cops. Aside from the previous job being mentioned on the news, he had no reason to believe they were onto him. Bells above the door jingled as he held it for a woman, with a smile. Waiting in line for a cup of coffee, he checked over his shoulder and then glanced at his watch. It would have joined his other belongings at the pawn shop if not for its sentimental value. A sharp pain settled in his lower back, brought on by the hard plastic seats. Sipping his black coffee, fingertip tapping wildly against the table, Hank watched the parking lot. A cloud of exhaust plumed, signifying Jake had arrived. An average-sized man stepped out of his monstrous truck. The haze dissipated, revealing Hank's nephew, too stubborn to buy something practical or affordable. Sporting dark-ringed eyes and dirty Wranglers, Jake looked like he'd been on another video game bender. Jake's father, Hank's brother, complained about them often. "That fucking Call of Duty," he remembered his brother saying. The woman behind the counter slapped a roll of change against the register. The other window front booths were empty, leaving them some privacy. Hank checked over his shoulder to assure himself the woman wasn't listening. He'd also motioned for Jake to lower his volume several times. He leaned in, whispering, "I know there's nearly $1,000 worth of jewelry in that casket." Jake nodded a couple of times, but said nothing. Gripping tight to his coffee, Hank said, "Just like last time, we meet at 11. There shouldn't be any interference." Jake patted a yawn, but kept silent. On the way out, Hank waved to the woman behind the counter. "See you tomorrow, Rita." Rita returned the wave. Elvis played through the speakers of his truck as he tapped his foot. A series of thoughts floated around in his mind, mostly memories of a simpler time. There'd been a time when he hadn't been dodging a loan shark at every turnaround, a time when he'd been happy, when Rachel had only been a baby. The truck's lights extinguished. As he walked across the dirt parking lot, he kept an eye out for an ugly Cadillac. He couldn't afford to bump into him. His kneecaps couldn't handle it. Illuminating the entrance to his apartment building was a small light which buzzed. Flittering bugs thumped against it. Hank gave it a wide berth with a wary eye. A strong odor of fish wafted through the first floor hallway. New tenants had taken the first apartment. Judging by the array of scents, they ate seafood often. He grumbled his complaints before wandering upstairs. When inside, he saw the eviction notice he'd thrown away, uncrumpled on the table. His daughter, Rachel, had fished it out of the bin. The TV wasn't on, so he imagined she'd already gone to bed. The slow ache of frustration crept across his mind. He wished he'd been better at hiding their dire situation. Once, he could pull the wool over her eyes, but at 15, she saw through his bullshit. She was a mature 15, too, who got mistaken for an adult too often. With a click of the remote, the TV flickered on. The cabinets were bare, as was the fridge. A saucepan filled with water banged against the burner, followed by a packet of chicken-flavored ramen. The water bubbled as he listened to the TV in the corner. A beautiful anchor rambled on about the rise in gas prices. Hank gripped the bridge of his nose, frustrated by the endless inflation. He had checked the weather obsessively for the past week, ensuring there would be little interference. The last grave robbing had left the news cycle, and he patted himself on the back to escape it. He considered going into his daughter's room to talk, but thought better of it. Their relationship was constantly on the rocks. Being a single dad had always been challenging. Although his landscaping business had failed, he knew Rachel was better off with him than her mother. After watching the weather, he turned to ESPN, where the Celtics embarrassed themselves for the third game in a row. Before halftime, he'd drifted off to sleep in his recliner. The alarm on his phone woke him at 10. The kinks in his back popped as he stretched. Outside the window, the skies looked clear. Even a couple of stars poked through the light pollution. The Keurig rattled and banged as it slowly poured a strong line of coffee. It sputtered, threatening to die. A strong smack to its side brought it back to life until it finished. The alien sticker on his thermos made him chuckle as he tightened the cap. Careful not to wake his neighbors, Hank tiptoed down the stairs. The odor of fish had been replaced by cleaning products. From the tool shed behind his building, he grabbed the shovels. Carefully, he lowered them into the bed of his truck. His eyes grazed every window, making sure he wasn't being watched. Driving through town, looking at all the houses, Hank considered how abnormal his life had become. While most people were sleeping, he was digging. He longed for the days when his landscaping business had increased, back when he had a sense of purpose. On a dirt road half a mile from the cemetery, he stepped out of the truck and stretched his legs, looking up at the bright moon above. He had decided they could dig by the moonlight and spare the flashlight batteries. As he waited for Jake, he thought back on the eviction notice. He couldn't let that happen. With this score, he'd catch up on the rent and buy himself time. The last thing he wanted was for Rachel to go. The back-breaking labor didn't bother him. He'd worked in that cemetery many years ago, doing the same thing in reverse. Another engine rumbled up the dirt road, country music blaring from the radio. It came to a stop 20 feet away. Conway Twitty's voice dropped off. Wearing a camouflage hat and a stupid grin, Jake dropped out of the truck. Hank slapped a shovel into his nephew's hands. "Did you bring the thing?" Jake shuffled through the cab before pulling out the radio. He turned a dial and it came to life. Police squabbled back and forth. Some assholes had dragged an ATM, giving them plenty to do. Jake smiled. "It looks like we've got time." The moon shone brightly above, lighting the path across the cemetery. The wind rustled the treetops. Off in the distance, a lone owl hooted. Hank crossed the cemetery with his head on a swivel, mindful of the stones jutting from the ground. He'd tripped on a few during his time there. Wintergreen wafted through the air, and he knew his nephew had just put in a plug of tobacco. The shovel dragged on the ground behind Jake as he asked, "Why do you insist on parking so far away?" Hank paused long enough to give his nephew a disappointed look. "If we parked near the cemetery, people would notice. Nobody can see the trucks when we park on the service road." Jake spat a line of chew that defaced a headstone. If it wasn't his brother's son, he'd fire him. Hank loved his nephew, but the boy had no future. His days were spent playing Call of Duty, drinking Mountain Dew, and discussing hunting. Since dropping out his sophomore year, his future looked dismal, at best. The layout of the cemetery had been etched into his memory. He'd dug tons of graves and mowed the lawn hundreds, if not thousands, of times. Wind whispered through the trees as they moved toward their destination. Their tools clashed to the ground. Hank looked around, ensuring they were alone. Crickets chirped distantly. He might have called it a nice night if they weren't about to exhume someone. Chunks of sod flew in all directions as Hank pulled them out by hand. The first shick of the shovel sank home. Jake had taken his place on the other side of the grave. He'd have hired a third digger if he'd trusted another person. They worked diligently with little conversation. Occasionally, they'd pause for a drink from the thermos. The conversation between the two of them wasn't fun for Hank. He'd listened to enough of Jake's hunting stories for one lifetime. Even on such a cold night, sweat dripped from his forehead. He imagined himself removing the diamond from the old lady's hand, and it sent a chill up his spine. He'd always hated that part, fearing she might grab him. Irrational as it may be, Hank imagined it every time. Along with his mountain of debt, he tried not to think about the karma that might follow him from disturbing the dead in their eternal slumber. Anything. He'd do anything to keep Rachel safe. Jake paused for a drink of coffee, alien sticker poking between bony fingers. He then hawked a loogie off into the distance. The thermos dropped back into the nearby grass. Before sinking the blade into the dirt again, he spoke. "It's fucking creepy out here." Hank only grunted in response. After jabbing and tossing a shovelful of dirt, Jake stopped. "Did you hear that?" Hank turned his head. "I didn't hear anything." "Exactly." For a second, Hank leaned against his shovel. The curse words were bubbling up. He wanted to tell his nephew he was being lazy when he noticed the crickets had stopped chirping. Even the breeze against the trees had lightened. A rustle erupted from the woods, earning a curious look. He sank the blade twice before it happened again, closer. With dawn lurking shortly, Hank persisted. There wasn't enough time for ghost stories and tomfoolery. He'd only sunk the blade halfway before Jake stammered, words fumbling from his mouth. He stumbled a couple of feet before catching his heel and falling into the pile of dirt. A shaking finger pointed to the woods. His face had gone pale.
Red eyes.
At first, Hank wanted to dismiss it, but his nephew wasn't an actor. He climbed out of the grave and followed Jake's finger to a patch of woods. He saw nothing. To be sure, he shuffled the flashlight from his belt and clicked it on. The beam traced in and out of the trees. Mounds of dirt surrounded him as he stared off into the distance, following the light with a curious but unamused gaze. The crickets still had yet to return. Hank couldn't hide the apprehension in his voice.
"You see, there's nothing out."
The light touched something before it moved. Branches and bushes snapped in its way. He froze, jaw hanging open. Whatever it was, he hadn't gotten a good look at it.
"It's probably a deer," he whispered,
but even he didn't believe it. It certainly didn't look like a deer. Hank's eyes were glued to that spot in the woods for a long while. The more rational part of his brain took over, and he realized it had probably moved on. He choked on the words,
"We need to get back to work."
After Jake climbed back into the hole, the color returned to his face. He mumbled with the shovel in his hand,
"I got a bad feeling about this."
Without taking his eyes off the woods, Hank pierced the ground. Thump! He'd found the lid of the vault. For a second, their eyes met and they both smiled. The shoveling continued in a hurry before a pattering of clicks erupted from the dark woods. They both paused, staring at each other briefly before braving a look. Jake asked,
"What was that?"
The clicks occurred again, and Hank tried to interpret them, but he'd never heard anything like it before. He turned on the flashlight with a trembling hand and traced the woods again. He wasn't sure he wanted to see whatever made that ungodly noise. In all his years, he'd never encountered anything like that before. Judging by the look on Jake's face, he hadn't either. The flashlight beam danced and raced through the thick woods. It had gone silent again. The flashlight clicked back into his belt and he reached for the shovel. In his periphery,
Hank saw a man standing at the edge of the trees. He turned to look. A ferocious flap broke the silence like a flag in a hurricane. A horrendous shriek followed. The outline of a winged creature blotted the moon before it landed only feet away. Its beady red eyes stared at them. Two antennae jutted from its brows, twitching. Pincher-like things flexed on either side of its mouth. It stood on two legs like a man, but it was no man. Its pinchers spread. The clicks led into a horrendous screech. If not for the paralytic fear, Hank would have covered his ears. The best he could do was cringe and try not to scream. The shovels landed on the ground, and they stumbled out of the hole, sliding in the loose dirt. Their feet pounded against the grass as they broke for the trucks. With his heart in his throat, Hank stole a glance and didn't see it. With his back turned, his foot clipped a headstone, and he stumbled. A sharp pain throbbed in his ankle. A looming fear overcame him. It could land on his back at any second. His fingers dug for purchase in the grass, and his legs worked like pistons. There wasn't any time to assess the damage. Ahead of him, Jake ran without looking back. Massive wings beat the sky, whooshing as the creature dove for Jake. It plunged, descending hundreds of feet in a split second. With immense pain ripping in every step, Hank screamed, "Jake!" In response to his name, Jake swung his head around. For an instant, he'd taken his eyes off the headstones, and that's when he tripped. The creature missed him by inches. A wave of relief swept over Hank, a fleeting one. Its massive wings rippled. Regaining height, it let out another ear-piercing shriek, the loudest one thus far. It vibrated his skull, and he swore he felt it in his fillings. Wincing, Hank clapped his hands over his ears. It did nothing to protect him. He desperately searched for it, but the woods were just too dark. With every step, unimaginable pain stemmed from his ankle. The vast distance between them seemed like miles as he hobbled toward his nephew. Jake fumbled to find his feet, looking like a newly born calf. Its merciless red eyes illuminated from a tree. Hank's stomach dropped. From its treetop perch, it pounced, gaining both momentum and ascension. Its rugged wings tore at the sky before it swooped again. From across the cemetery, Hank screamed. He saw the beast descend on his nephew as if from a horror flick. Jake couldn't get away in time. With its massive talons, it shredded into his back. The screams of agony sent chills racing up and down Hank's spine. No amount of protest drew its attention from Jake. Popping and crackling commenced as it swiped at him again, tearing his flesh in tendrils. Before he reached the monster, it turned to look at him. Those cold red eyes stared as its talons dug and clawed at the meat on Jake's back. In an instant, it launched into the air. Unable to track it, he lost sight of the thing. Lying on the ground, gasping for air, Jake shook violently. Hank approached. He lifted Jake's head into his lap where he rocked him. Trickles of blood ran over his knees. A few wet coughs escaped his lips before his life faded away. Every time Hank closed his eyes, he saw those menacing reds glowing from the trees. The flap of its wings echoed in his psyche. Placing his deceased nephew on the ground, he rose to his feet. Agony roared from his ankle. 50 feet ahead, the creature perched on a headstone. It stood between him and the truck. He looked from the monster to his truck and decided he couldn't make it. He looked around, hoping there might be something helpful, like a weapon, and found nothing. Kneeling on the ground, he shuffled through Jake's pockets, hoping to find a pocket knife or something. Nothing. The only option he had was to turn back. Those eerie clicks filled the silence. Its silhouette on the stone reminded him of gargoyles. Turning his back on the creature brought forth paranoia he'd never known before. He checked over his shoulder every few feet, certain it would come for him. 5 rows of headstones passed before the beast took flight. Its fierce wings rippled through the air. Thankfully, Hank heard it coming. Just like Jake, he ducked seconds before impact. Its sharp talons missed him by inches, sending a gust of wind that riddled him in goose flesh. Jolts of pain shot through his leg as he hobbled toward the open grave. He might have lost track of it if not for its luminous eyes. Off in the trees, it stood, a bird stalking its prey. Feet from the mound of dirt, he stumbled. Another massive shriek filled the silence, and he knew he had no time. Sinking his hands into the grass, Hank pulled himself foot after agonizing foot until he fell into the hole. He landed on the vault with a thud, knocking the wind out of him. Gasping for air, with stars dancing in his vision, he groped around for the shovel. Trembling fingers wrapped around the wooden handle. The creature's outline stood on the edge of the grave. Dizzy and wounded, Hank found his feet, using the shovel to regain his balance. It swiped at him, missing his head by inches. Those awful clicks filled the small void of the tomb. With the shovel, he swung, clipping its leg. It screeched. The monster jumped maybe 3 feet, parted its wings, and descended on him. Razor-sharp claws lowered toward his face. Blindly, he swung the shovel. It hit something with a tear, like ripping paper. It wasn't until they were squabbling in the grave that he realized he'd pierced its wing. Shrieks rattled his ears as he swung the shovel, catching it on the narrow walls on either side. He kicked and punched, swung and fought. A lucky shot caught the monster in the head with a terrible bang. It fell still. In disbelief, Hank stood there, wielding the shovel. He waited for it to regain its feet and attack. It didn't. After a little while, Hank climbed his way out of the grave. The click of his flashlight revealed a winged monster, something he would have otherwise believed to be a myth. He grasped the shovel and stood over the grave with no other choice. If he were to bring attention to the authorities, he'd have to admit what he'd been doing. He couldn't do that. He couldn't go to prison and leave his daughter all alone. The first shovel full of dirt landed on his nephew. The second on the monster. He went on like that until the sun crested the horizon. Then, from the graveyard, he fled. You've been listening to Quiet Desperation by Clarence Carter. And now, to close out our show tonight, I present Wearisome Necessary Things by J.R. Hamantaschen. You did a good job naming him. Jordan Damrick? A solid name. You know, with some people nowadays, you never know what silliness they're going to come up with. That was Clayton, sitting on the couch in the Damrick's apartment beside his longtime girlfriend, Annabelle, who herself was wishing in vain for a proposal and estimating when she should give Clayton an ultimatum. 2-month-old baby Jordan was dressed in a black and white striped onesie that read, "I just did 9 months on the inside." "Well, my first choice for his name was King Kong Moon Assault, but the old ball and chain here talked me out of it," said the boy's father, Jeff Damrick, thumb to his wife Megan. "Women," Clayton grumbled. "Can't live with them," Annabelle added, In their relationship, she was usually reduced to adding stingers to Clayton's comments.
I just wanted him to grow up knowing he could be the first person to not just visit the moon, but to go down in history as the first person to assault the moon. Is that so wrong?
Visiting the moon. I mean, what is this, the 1950s? We all need to dream bigger.
Could have been an inspiration to us all, and what is he now?
Just another Jordan. Clayton deadpanned, then smiled over at Megan, who was shaking her head.
Darn right he's a Jordan.
Megan lifted baby Jordan up and down. On the ascent, he smiled, because he was enjoying it, or the position change helped him relieve gas. Either way, it was cute, and elicited smiles and an emphatic, "Aww," from Annabelle. This was how the repartee with Clayton had gone throughout the entire course of their decade or so of friendship, back when Jeff and Megan were adamant they didn't want children. Back before Annabelle had even met Clayton, and therefore missed all the times Clayton had agreed with the general sentiment of, "Yeah, kids are cool, but not for me." Clayton was impressed that Megan either recovered nicely or had retained her slim figure throughout the entire pregnancy. And as this was the first time that Jeff had seen Annabelle for months, Jeff found himself surprised that he still was so aroused by her approachable, modest good looks and easygoing way. In a type of dream logic, he figured having a child, the most grown-up thing someone could do, might stop him from finding other women attractive. Yeah, right. Just like when he turned 30 half a decade ago and thought to himself, "Okay, you're 30 years old. The time for dwelling and neurosis is over." Annabelle hoped Clayton took note that having a kid didn't seem to have restricted Jordan's sense of humor. To that end, she asked, "So how different are things now, with a kiddo?" A phrasing she regretted, as it didn't serve her purpose as a leading question.
"Well, I'd say the biggest difference is now we have a kid to take care of all the time."
"Interesting, interesting. I'm taking notes. Annie, did you get that?"
"Sleep. That's the real thing. Oh, how you miss sleep," Megan added.
"Yeah, sleep is necessary," Clayton said with a smile, grateful his time with a baby would be limited to these few hours.
"Oh, God, sleep. How I miss you,"
Megan groaned.
"But it's all worth it for you, little man,"
she added to the rising and falling Jordan, as if he was silently questioning her loyalty.
"I don't know if you feel the same way, honey, but outside of all the stuff we need to do for the little guy, I don't feel profoundly different. I mean, I have stopped rounding up and killing small animals I find in the alleyway, but really that was coincidental. I was planning on giving that up anyway."
Clayton looked at Annabelle. "See, these are the sacrifices the mainstream media doesn't want you to hear about."
"True, so true," supplemented Annabelle.
These rare few hours among friends were a cordoned-off alternative reality, where parenthood, like everything else, was all irreverent humor. One unacknowledged substantial difference in the Damrocks' new life was that this was the first time seeing their friends for months. Beyond the jokes, Jeff made sure he was as involved as Megan, which one couldn't really avoid anyway, in a two-bedroom apartment where the baby slept in a bassinet placed in front of the bed. When Jordan woke, crying in the middle of the night, it was Jeff who fetched him and brought him to Megan for feeding. He worried just as much as she did if the poop looked a strange color, or if Jordan wasn't drinking enough, or that maybe not enough milk was being produced. Throughout the visit, the Damrocks had been playing, at sufficiently low volume, a baby song playlist off their Bluetooth speaker. Jeff was sad at how few of the baby classics he knew, and didn't remember much music in his house growing up, from babyhood onward. Their apartment was festooned with baby toys, none of which baby Jordan could do anything with at his age, when he was little more than a sentient lumpen potato. Clayton squeezed a ball made up of many circles.
"A ball? The classics never go out of style."
"That's actually a fancy O-ball."
A ball is just a ball. Stick that bad boy up your ass and you'll know where it gets its name, said Jeff. Clayton laughed, smiled widely, and leered enthusiastically while the conversation picked up volume. Oh, ball, baby. Now you know what I want for Christmas. Jordan looked deep in thought. Maybe he didn't like that joke. Or, more likely, a poop may be forthcoming. Jeff took notice.
Wait for it. It may be coming.
I want to start a movie review TikTok with him. Looks like he's about to give some unsolicited reviews. Hey, Jordan, what do you think of the latest Blumhouse movie?
Looks like he's really mulling that one over, said Clayton. They all fell expectantly silent as Jordan gave a little inhale. They all thought to themselves how strange it was to avidly wait for a baby to loudly shit itself. Jeff listened with a strange intensity to the baby playlist. Jordan emitted a little burp.
A mixed review, then, said Megan.
Yeah, not so bad. Not terrible, then. Maybe we'll check it out, offered Annabelle.
What kind of baby song has the lyrics yearning, burning, yearning?
It took the others a beat to realize Jeff was supposedly asking about the song they were listening to. Clayton at first smiled, thinking it was the beginning of a joke, then pursed his eyes and chuckled despite himself.
What?
Megan asked. Annabelle made an exaggerated face, as if she had expected someone to ask a question, but not that question.
The song. It just went something like yearning, burning, yearning. You heard it, right, Jordache?
That's a trick learned early in parenting. When something unpleasant or awkward arises, address it to the baby to break the tension. That way you can ask something without really asking.
I didn't hear it.
Megan looked at her phone to see the playlist.
The song's called Lava Shake.
Makes sense, though. Burning lava, don't burn yourself, right? I mean, yearning, though, that's at least like a pre-K word, right? Clayton tilted his head conspiratorially.
See, I'm onto something,
said Jeff on autopilot.
Okay, I'm restarting it now.
The song, as befitting a wildly popular kids' song, did have a rhythmic, chant-like quality to it. They all waited for Jeff to say something like, "There!" when the offending lyrics repeated, and the others all listened, still smiling, looking forward to getting to the bottom of this mystery.
I think it was when they said turning. It said turning, turning, turning. That could have been it?
That makes the most sense, Clayton offered, which everyone agreed to.
Yeah,
Jeff agreed distractedly. A few pauses, and then, to fill the air,
would have been badass, though, if it had been yearning and burning.
Teach them young what's in store for them later in life. All burning and yearning, said Megan.
There was more chatter, Megan taking the lead as Jeff's input fell behind. At one point, there was a question from Annabelle about what baby poop actually smelled like from a breastfed baby, to which Megan described it as pretty mild, just maybe sour milk, and, feeling the need to say something to right the course of his spinning center of gravity, Jeff added,
"Surprisingly, though, tastes like creme brulee."
Jeff had never even had creme brulee, but that didn't matter for the joke, of course. But whatever he said didn't matter, because as the song had repeated, he'd heard it again, as distinctly as the first time. Yearning, burning, yearning. Jeff made no attempt to think about what he'd heard the day before, or to think about how much he missed spending time with friends. That precious space where burdens and responsibilities got set aside for just a few shimmering hours. He couldn't think about what that meant because that would lead nowhere good, and there was nothing to think about anyway. He'd just misheard, he lied to himself whenever the thought came up. That was all. There were other things to worry about, like driving alone with Jordan in the back seat. He and his wife had always driven together, with him usually in the back seat to comfort Jordan, but she had a doctor's appointment and there were things that couldn't wait, Or at least his paranoia about driving alone wasn't, he figured, an honorable enough excuse to procrastinate. Jeff had always had a utilitarian view of driving in the best circumstances, had always disliked city driving, and driving with first a pregnant wife and now a baby, forget about it. It was lunacy, these death machines driven by God knows who, treating highways like the Autobahn and lane markers as suggestions. To think, he was betting his baby's life on the gamble that he wouldn't encounter the next dumbfuck speeding high school kid destined to be a New York Post headline. Jeff had noticed no appreciable decrease in tailgating or other dangerous maneuvers since putting up their baby on board sticker. Maybe he should put two up, one to represent Jordan and one for him. When he made it home with Jordan from the supermarket with all they needed, he felt fatigued and drained. Jordan had perhaps gotten the memo, giving Daddy an assist by keeping his cool for most of the ride and falling asleep with a passy on the way back. God, imagine if Jordan had been wailing the whole time. How on edge Jeff would have been. He caught himself thinking about the misapprehended song lyrics. Let myself go crazy. That's fine, as long as we make it home safely from this trip. Going crazy would be future Jeff's problem. On a day where Jeff and Megan were both sleep-drained, as Jordan had been really fussy last night. Fussy was a euphemism. Jordan had been fucking difficult. Just why wouldn't he go to sleep? Jeff experienced something while out on a midday walk that jolted him fully awake. He'd been thinking to himself that, as difficult as this had all been, his combination of paternity leave and accrued vacation time was running out, and how fucking dreadful it would be dealing with a lack of sleep when he actually had to get up early to go back to work. Work. Ugh, fuck. Those months leading up to his scheduled paternity leave were so glorious. Everyone letting him coast, feeling like the jet plane that gets to bide time until it speeds down the runway for liftoff. But upon departing, he got the distinct suspicion that his bosses favored the time off for him to find a different position. Jeff's pessimistic ruminating reached a feverish pitch when he heard someone let out what sounded like a refreshed exhalation, the type that existed only in the hoariest beer commercials. He turned and saw, from across the street, a cheery man smiling at him atop the open back of a truck. The man appeared to be laying on his stomach, tucking the truck bed under his armpits to let his arms sway over the side, his bent legs gaily kicking slowly behind him, as if he was a little girl pretending to be a mermaid, or, if done differently and more deliberately, like a woman sitting poolside attempting seduction. There could be no doubt the man was directing his attention directly at Jeff. Jeff didn't know what to say or do, whether to wave or something. Could this be someone he'd met recently? And he didn't want to look too hard, but the man was dressed normally and appeared respectable enough, i.e. was not a clearly deranged street person. So there was no ready explanation Jeff could see for this behavior. There appeared to be no one else around to witness this bright midday strangeness, to share a raised eyebrow and a, "What the fuck is this city coming to?" look of commiseration. The man made a show of smiling, looking upward and breathing deeply and luxuriously. Again, the type of over-the-top inhalation reserved for new cars, new babies, or new retirement. It didn't occur to Jeff to think how it was that, from all the way across the street, he saw the man's open mouth with such detail and experienced the inhale so vividly. The nights were getting worse, although that was, according to the baby apps they subscribed to, expected around the 3-month sleep regression. As work moved closer to the forefront of his mind, a layer of intemperate, staticky panic clung to everything else, as if every chore and task just needed to get done sooner, be done quicker. Megan still had a few more months off, lucky motherfucker, though he supposed he was technically the motherfucker now. Good for her. To get more time off work, he would have delivered triplets out of his asshole. Each day felt like it was just slipping away, obscured under a low-grade headache fog. Fortunately, Jordan slept decently during the day, though for only 45-minute intervals, and those brief reprieves were taken up by laundry, dishes, meal prepping, or pointless distractions, like looking up whether a visitor to the United Kingdom with limited time should visit Manchester or Birmingham. Consensus seemed to be Manchester. Jeff's relationship with Megan could have improved, the relationship becoming declarative and task-oriented, especially when sleep deprivation and baby screams became overwhelming. Jeff had worn the same pants for days, and when he sniffed the seed of them one night after taking them off, the first thought that came to mind was pasta primavera. It was when his onboarding documents from HR came in that the reality of work really set in, and he was instantly nostalgic for those stretched-out, vague, dead-zone days of paternity leave. He and Megan hadn't really discussed the practicalities of how this work transition was going to function. Another conversation to have, on top of the apartment baby-proofing he still hadn't completed, which was completely pointless, as they were with Jordan all the time. What, was he going to make a fast break for Tide Pods? And both the fucking crib and toddler table he was struggling to put together. Why Megan had ordered them together so prematurely was beyond him, especially given those giant crates were taking up about half of their living room. Good thing Jordan couldn't crawl or move yet. With their overpacked apartment, he'd only have room to spin around in a circle, like a snake eating its tail. Jeff was going for another walk to supposedly clear his head, while being unable to resist affording all of these ingredients and this gumbo of stress equal attention. He felt the stressors stacking upon each other. Let it all just topple over. When he heard a friendly, if loud, voice behind him.
Hey!
Jeff turned, and his stomach twisted to the memory of yearning, burning, yearning, and that strangely delirious man in the back of the truck. And he wished he could be lost in his mind again, because in his mind, the only one hurting him was himself. He had no proof the man before him was the same man he saw in the back of the truck. In fact, he somewhat doubted it. But this man invoked the same unmistakable vibe. What that vibe was, Jeff couldn't exactly pinpoint. But it was something like the same nauseous realization a man hanging for his life off a cliff face must have when, expecting rescue, he looks up to see his arrogant aggressor sauntering over to take a clearer look. "Hi," was all Jeff could muster, and he knew he was being paranoid and crazy. This was just a guy on the street, this somewhat grizzled but still appealing working man, maybe in his mid-40s. And before the man spoke, Jeff knew he was somehow still deluding himself again. When Jeff mentally steadied himself, his heart again sank even deeper, again for reasons he could not articulate. Then the man spoke and removed all doubt.
"We cannot believe you went through with it and had a kid!"
You know when you see a shirtless man who's in extremely good shape, and then see that same man soon after in regular clothing, and know that being clothed doesn't do justice to how impressive and intimidating he is? Jeff felt something like that, but less about the man's body, more about his face. There was more going on beyond that face. Jeff sensed this man could open wide that mouth and explode everything Jeff knew about this world. And there was no logical or ready explanation for this instinct, just as the mouse never needs to first be taught to fear the owl. Jeff went through the instinctual rigmarole of pretending like this was anything like a reasonable interaction, whereas someone had just said something out of line and needed to be corrected. "Excuse me?" "It's gotten almost unbearable.
I'd say we're almost to the point of taking pity on you. But that's not it. You are the gift that keeps on giving, but even that was almost too much for us. We've been drinking off you for years. We just couldn't help ourselves. Fuck-ups like you, we just breathe in that shame that just flows right out of you. And to think you went and had a kid.
Even now, Jeff could tell this man was quietly savoring the taste of something.
You are a complete, incompetent fuck-up, and I'm not even saying that in any way other than matter-of-factly. You've known your whole life you're a mess, and that isn't ever going to change. You can tell yourself whatever you want, but some people are just fucked. And thank God for that. We can smell the flavors off you from miles and miles away.
But to think you went and had a kid. You should have listened to those instincts of yours. Ever hear that expression? When someone tells you what they really think, listen. Well, no one knows you better than yourself. And what are the things you tell yourself? Well, when you think all those terrible things about yourself, it's because you're right on the money.
What does one say to that? Jeff couldn't speak. Every word was further confirmation of being entombed in a nightmare. But this was a nightmare that hurt. And never in a nightmare did his guts react so strongly. His insides were roiling in fear and anxiety. If he moved, something would burst and he'd spill out on the sidewalk. Through his torpor, he noted there were a few other people out, that this conversation was taking place in a recognizable reality. There was an elderly couple across the street, and a young woman allowing her dog to sniff the grass half a block up. Cars, the same unremarkable types of cars he saw every day, unremarkably obeying traffic signals and doing what unremarkable cars do. And could someone please save him? Not just from this man, but this existence. Could he run across the street to that elderly couple, weeping, and tell them he was scared? And they would say, "What's the matter, young man?" And listen to his sob story and tell him, "It's okay. Nothing's that bad. It will all be okay." And could he believe it? Jeff's throat was parched, and after what felt like an eternity, he tried to speak. Jeff worried his brain had broken. He'd had a stroke, but then he regained himself. There was confusion, but he couldn't even muster outrage because some part of himself had always known that a confrontation like this would find him.
"Why are you telling me this?" is what he could come up with, and he said it quietly but firmly. Maybe if he showed resolve, this man would realize he was mistaken and change the entire course of what was to come. Jeff wouldn't call it a smile, but the man did something similar.
"Because what the fuck could you do about it now, anyway? You dug your own grave. You're going to sink so low, you'll be feeding us for months. We'll be able to just stick our tongues out in the air and lap it all up. Because some people exist to make other people feel better. And maybe defective fuck-ups like you exist because the byproduct of your fucked-upness is to feed us. But now, you've gone and done it and had a kid. Now you've really gone and done it."
Megan had every right to criticize Jeff for being distracted and aloof for the remainder of the day, although, Jeff thought, maybe not the right to be so difficult about it. It's not like he was doing nothing. It was still a foreign body sensation to be, say, cleaning pump parts and changing diapers when the very foundations of his universe were being unmoored. If only she knew. Or, more accurately, if only there was some way he could tell her what exactly. That his lifelong tendency to depression and anxiety, which had seemingly been moderately managed these last few years, had turned into some kind of, dare he say, psychotic mania? Or, at a minimum, there was something terribly awry? Or, a more realistic possibility, he was doing some version of amplifying, misconstruing, or misunderstanding? Who wouldn't believe that a recent parent is sort of losing his mind? Ha ha ha, isn't that the joke? Then older parents tell you, boy, you'll miss those days. No, that couldn't be it. Strangers don't just cut you down like that on a normal weekday stroll while ringing some kind of cosmic bell inside you and you dismiss it as a misunderstanding. The man had said his piece and just walked away, with Jeff feigning to himself like he was going to chase the man down and do something. And then the man was gone, and normality reasserted itself. In horror movies, characters suffer some extraordinary delusion in service of a jump scare, like imagining they see giant cockroaches pouring out of a bathtub or a desiccated corpse appearing behind them in a mirror, and then the next scene they just shake it off with a, phew, must be nerves. If only movies could serve as anything like a roadmap as to acceptable behavior, then he'd have nothing to worry about. Or was this all just one big, gigantic, comical nothing? Some ready explanation that was eluding him. He looked down at his son, who was now able to smile at him, and nothing else seemed to matter. Everything else was just noise. Surely, it was just all noise, and whatever had just recently happened to him out there had no bearing on him here, in their bedroom. And when he woke up in response to Jordan's early morning cries, it took his sleep-deprived mind some time to refresh itself as to the recent chaos, and the stomach churn began afresh. While his son and his wife napped, he Googled around for strange incidents nearby. He resorted to searching for Reddit posts about strange men in the neighborhood who started confrontations on personal matters, but no dice. He saw a post about an autistic teenage boy who had gone missing approximately a mile away the day prior, and maybe he should call the police about it and... say what, exactly? Officer, a big mean man made me feel bad about my shortcomings. To ask the question was to answer it. Although he was being stalked, was that it? That could be something. He could call the police about that. Tell Megan that. How else would this man know so much about him? Jeff racked his brain for some kind of explanation, but was certain, no, he had never met that man before. Neither him nor the mermaid in the truck. That's the tact to take. Tell Megan he was being stalked. But God, why add more stress and panic? He resolved himself to tell her, but at the right time and with the right phrasing. And he would report it to the police, at least, just to be proactive and do his due diligence. Just tell them the man threatened him and mentioned his son, at least to have a paper record. And what else should he tell Megan? Should he tell her the snippets of memories, more like jumbled copies of distant images that gave further pause to everything he was thinking of doing? A memory of being about 7 and telling his mother, "There are older boys laughing at me," although knowing they weren't just boys. Feeling beside himself with humiliation about something or other, maybe something about how his father made him feel, and there being a semicircle of older boys around him in his backyard, staring and laughing at him, almost in a pitying way, and with a melodramatic child's clarity, he knew they were monsters there to delight in his suffering, because he was incompetent and useless, and he didn't know why. His mother was deceased, so he couldn't ask her what she remembered, and his father may as well have been dead too, for as much as he was worth, so there was no chance of him having any memory of anything said among the family, let alone anything important. And this blended with a different, more benign memory that felt related. He was a teenager at an outdoor music festival with his friend Peter Jr. and Peter's father, Peter Sr. Peter Sr. gave him lawn chairs to set up, but Jeff just couldn't seem to get them right, only for Peter Sr. to eventually pause give a drawn-out stare, and finally point out, in a way that was meant to be humorous and understanding, that they were upside down. And Jeff didn't remember those monsters being there then, but thinking now, they should be. They would like that. Late night, early morning, who could tell anymore? The routine seemed to be that he would wake to Jordan's cries, either feed him a bottle or fetch him for Megan and keep himself awake while she breastfed, spend an indiscernible amount of time coaxing Jordan back to sleep in his bassinet with his pacifier, pray for him to sleep, thank God when he finally did, put his head on the pillow, and wake up to another cry or the phone alarm a second later. Jeff had only one more full day of leave before work started up. He knew he wouldn't be able to sleep and wasn't even trying to. He was enjoying the quiet and the calm of the bedroom. Jordan was asleep in his bassinet at the foot of their bed, and when the timing allowed, he could hear the occasional contented sleeping baby suck of the pacifier in between Megan's light snoring. Beyond the bassinet, on the opposite wall, there was a rocking chair, which had taken Jeff too long to build, which, after the various discarded clothes were pushed off, was used to feed Jordan. Behind the rocking chair was the room's sole window. This window was a stubborn, moody little bitch, perhaps upset about being the only window in the room, because no matter how much one adjusted the blackout curtain, it always allowed ambient light to enter. In one corner of the room, they kept a soft blue nightlight near Jeff's closet, which had since become invaded by both Megan's clothes and various baby necessities. The corner opposite was taken up by an armoire, whose interior and exterior were shared by all three of them. He hoped this long stretch of undisturbed night could last forever, although even this he couldn't fully enjoy, because he knew sleep was too fleeting a commodity. He wished he had someone to talk to, someone who could help. Sometimes thinking wasn't his friend, because when he thought too much, the weight of the situation pressed more firmly down upon him. What had he done to safeguard his family tonight, other than make sure, over and over, that the apartment door was locked and the windows closed? While the mind could rationalize, deeper down where instinct lay, where there dwells a sixth sense we haven't yet created a word for, there was felt the plunge of defeat. These monsters had been eating off him his whole life, lapping up his reliable supply of defectiveness. But now, with this drastic life change he couldn't handle, the taste was stronger, and they couldn't resist, pushing for one extreme, delectable bite. He blinked rapidly and was awake without ever knowing if he'd ever been asleep. He woke with disintegrating dreams of wrestling shapes. In the darkness, he could make out the outline of his wife's back facing him. He sat up slightly to look beyond the bassinet and could dimly make out maternity clothes draped over the rocking chair. There was a vertical coherence to the mess of clothes. They appeared to form a slumped shape. He sat up, waiting to identify the discrete articles of clothing that created this illusion, but even after his eyes adjusted to the room, the form still remained. Jeff leaned forward, telling himself he was checking on Jordan, although his eyes never left the still rocking chair. He felt in the bassinet, found Jordan's dropped pacifier, and gave it back to him without resistance, feeling more than hearing the confirming wetness of the placed pacifier being greedily sucked. The top of the form shifted. There was the subtlest symmetrical movement in the deeper darkness, like steepled fingers ever so gently pressing against each other. Everything within turned to burning ice. Meaning disappeared, and all that remained was incomprehensible, insane terror, which his mind accepted so readily, as if partly relieved at the emergence of what he knew had always been peeking around the corners. The moment his hand left the firmly placed pacifier, trailed baby Jordan's body, and unmistakably felt what could only be a dry, open mouth. You've just heard Wearisome Necessary Things by J.R. Hamantaschen. J.R. Hamantaschen is a writer of short stories, having released several collections, including A Deep Horror That Was Very Nearly Awe, with a voice that is often still confused but is becoming ever louder and clearer, and You Shall Never Know Security. J.R. also co-hosts a horror podcast called The Horror of Nachos and Hamantaschen. You can find collections of his work at Velox Books, veloxbooks.com. And with that, my friends, we have finished up tonight's episode of Horror Hill. I hope that you'll return next week for more thrills and chills and all of that good stuff. Until then, listeners, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.